Welcome back to the K9 Campus Podcast. I'm Stace Carter here with Devin Gaston, and though we're on a bit of a delay, this episode brings us to our third and final report from the 2006 Association of Pet Dog Trainers Conference held in Kansas City, Missouri. In this episode, we're going to discuss two of the real highlights from this year's conference, the results of a seminal scientific survey on the use of shock collars and how that study is causing legislative ripples in Europe, and Dr. Patricia McConnell's new book, For the Love of a Dog, Understanding Emotion in You and Your Best Friend. If you've got any experience with dog training, you certainly understand how emotion plays into it. In this discussion, we'll see how Dr. McConnell explores the deep dive into those processes. Devin, welcome back from Kansas City. Did you enjoy your trip?
I had a great time. I was a little under the weather for the last day, which was what delayed the podcast. I had a rip-roaring head cold, which didn't make me the best speaker. Let's put it that way. Yeah. But I was alert enough and, you know, chugging the tea and the honey to make sure that I got, because really the Saturday, the conference went on one more day. I left a day early, but these two seminars were the primary reason that I went. So I was very, very excited. So the first seminar was given by a PhD and a vet named Esther Schalke, S-C-H-A-L-K-E, and I apologize to anyone for mispronouncing that. She's a German researcher. What a fascinating woman. She got her veterinary degree in Hanover in 1997 and her doctorate in veterinary medicine from the University of Hanover as well.
Gotcha.
And one of her friends, I guess in Germany, one of their big problems there are wild boars. And dogs like to chase the wild boars.
They get
gored by the wild boars. So one of her friends asked her, hey, do you think shock collars are humane?
Right.
And because that's one of the primary ways of handling dogs that chase the boars.
Right.
And she realized that she didn't really know. I mean, she was definitely more into more humane methods of training, but she didn't know if there'd actually been any definitive studies on it. So she decided to look into it. So she looked at some previous research, and there wasn't a lot of it. She looked at a study in 2000 that was done in Europe, and it was a pretty small control group. And also, all the dogs lived in different households, so it was really hard to tell what their stress levels were anyway, because the environments they lived in were so different. And and the control group was so small, and it was based on deer chasing, and there was the ages of the dogs were different, the breeds, the homes, the training methods. A lot of times, the dogs were in the study after having been in a bunch of different training methods, none of which worked. So
there was a lot of data, but it wasn't
incredibly rigorous. It was incredibly inconclusive. So then there was another study. But by the way, even with that sort of non-rigorous control group, after the shock of all the dogs, there was a lowering of the ear position, a high-sounding yelp, tongue licking, and a lowering of the tail position. And what was really interesting is that they returned to the area where the dogs were trained a week later, and they saw a lot of these same behaviors, which a lot of us know of as calming signals. Gave a good, in her book, Calming Signals, What Your Dogs Tells You, kind of outlines ways that you can really see stress symptoms in dogs. So even a week later in this environment, the dogs were displaying the same behavior.
Okay.
So it was clear that that environment was stressful, but once again, the control group was kind of a polluted group. So then there's another study in Wisconsin, and this study attempted to be a bit more rigorous, but the stress symptoms were reported by the owners of the dogs.
Right. And I have to tell you, still not a controlled group.
I mean, I find that the vast majority of the people in my classes, when I point out that their dog is displaying stress, it shocks them.
So this happened just
the other day. I had a woman working with her German
too.
Shepherd, and she said, oh, she's just tuned me out. Well, the dog had tuned her out. The dog was really stressed out and was trying to process that and sit. On top of that, you know, answering a cue on top of that was a little bit too much for the dog to ask. And when I pointed it out, and I actually had her take 10 steps back from her dog so she could see the body position and all of these, I mean, the dog was averting her eyes and licking her lips and sort of doing all of this classic stress stuff. It really surprised her. So these were not reliable, you know, to base your study on the observation of a dog's owner.
is not terribly reliable. Okay, so let's get on to the study that she did, because she was, from a scientific point of view, apparently very rigorous. Now, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a researcher.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, for those of you out there that are listening who might be, you know, there might be, forgive me for any error I make in sort of retelling this event, but basically they used beagles. So they started with all the same breed, and they used 5 females and 9 males that displayed hunting behavior. So these were beagles that would chase things. And they were chosen from the university's laboratory breeding stock and trained by the same trainer. Now, they all lived in the same kennel, so their environment was the same, and they basically divided the group up into 3. There was group A, otherwise known as the aversion group, and those were dogs that received an electric shock at the moment they touched the prey.
Okay.
Then there was group H, otherwise known as the hear or recall group. Dogs trained to recall, and they received an electric shock when they did not respond to the recall. So they were chasing prey, they got called to come, they didn't respond, they got shocked.
Okay.
Then group R, random. These were dogs that were shocked in an arbitrary manner to assimilate poor owner timing.
Okay.
So this was basically how the average dog owner would, you know, sometimes when the dog takes off after the prey, sometimes when the dog gets to the prey, sometimes when the dog doesn't respond to a hear.
Right, right.
So it seemed much more random. Okay, so first thing they did is they went through an adaptive phase. And for 3 months, they brought the dogs into a room. It's kind of funny. They actually drove them from the kennel to the room in a trailer so that none of them would experience environmental stressors the others didn't, like a leaf falling in front of them or something.
Right, and this is part of keeping it a controlled experiment.
Right, exactly. And so for 3 months, they were taken into this room, and they were they got to hunt a dummy rabbit. They got to chase it all around.
Yeah.
And also, the dogs in group H were taught recall. That's the only training. No other dogs were taught recall.
Okay.
And they were trained for...
The dogs in group H.
Yeah, that's the hear group.
The ones that were shocked when they didn't recall were taught recall.
But at this point, in the adaptive phase, there was no shocking. It's like for 3 months, we're in this room, chase the dummy. That's the only training that was given, except for the hear dogs, which were also taught recall or come here. Okay. And basically what they did is they wanted to determine the base levels for saliva, cortisol, and heart rate. They wanted to use saliva cortisol because they were afraid that if they drew blood, that would be a stressor in itself. So during the adaptive phase, every day the dogs, their little cheek was swabbed. Mm-hmm. So that they got really used to their cheek being swabbed, and it was no big deal. And so what they basically did was, after the dogs played for about an hour, they did heart rate tests and saliva cortisol rates every 5 minutes, 5 times in a row, to kind of figure out what the base level was. Okay, now the main experiment then started 3 months later, and that's when the electric shocks were administered to the dogs according to the group that they were in. Experimentation for each individual was terminated if the beagle did not show interest in the prey for 3 consecutive days, or obeyed the recall signal, or the little beagle displayed distinct signs of stress, or after the 3rd application of an electric shock.
Okay.
So basically, no beagle was shocked more than 3 times.
Okay.
That was the bottom line. And then saliva sampling and heart rate measurements were carried out as preliminary testing. Now, they did an absolute cortisol value, and then they did a relative cortisol value. And scientists out there will know what that means. I'm just going to talk about the absolute cortisol values because they're the ones that make the most sense to me. But they were pretty close. I mean, both numbers were pretty close. It's not like one was hugely different than the other.
And we're going to consider that a sign of stress.
Yes,
basically.
Right. So, you know, they had the baseline just playing in the room, hunting a little prey. And actually, hunting prey is going to up those cortisol levels a little bit because hunting instincts are kicked in, which is one of the reasons why they did that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's the difference between just hunting? It's called simple hunting versus hunting impeded. In other words, we're trying to stop the hunting.
Ah, I see. Okay.
And so this is really what's kind of unbelievable. In group A, so this was the aversively trained, the second their mouth hit the prey, they were shocked.
Right, okay.
Their cortisol levels went up at the end of the week 31.3% after the shock.
Okay.
Okay, group H. So the group that was trained to come when called and were shocked when they didn't come when called. So the prey takes off. They go to chase it. They're come when called. They don't come. Their cortisol level went up 160%.
Wow. Okay.
Group R, which was the randomly shocked to mimic the average dog owner.
Right.
Their cortisol level went up 336%.
Wow. So over twice what the second group who came back when they didn't recall.
Right.
And over 100%.
And so
of the first group.
The basic contention here is that the group that had the lowest cortisol increase were shocked the moment their mouth touched the prey. So there was a very clear association for them between what the pain was related to.
They
it's
could
related
correlate.
To that
yeah, okay.
moment in time.
Right.
The coming when called, it went up a lot. But once again, it's like, you know, they didn't respond to a cue. And so there could be some association with why they got shocked, not as great. The random group, there's really no association. Sometimes when it's when you take off after the prey, sometimes when it gets near the prey. So now this is what really blew my mind. So little beagles went back to their kennel. Everything was hunky-dory. 4 weeks later, they're not shocked during any of this time.
Okay.
4 weeks later, they're brought back into this room. And their cortisol level was tested after an hour of being in the room, no prey present. No shock collars present.
Right.
4 weeks later, Group A had no increase in cortisol level.
Okay.
And that was the group where the timing was perfect. Group H, so these were the dogs that were...
That didn't recall.
Didn't recall.
When they were asked.
Their cortisol level
shocked.
Went up 207.89%.
Wow.
Four weeks later. The R group. So the group that we associate with the average dog owner.
The random shock group.
Their cortisol level went up 586%.
Wow. Almost 600%.
4 weeks later. So the conclusion of the study, and I'll just read it to you because it's a lot more eloquent than what I could say. The results of this study indicate that the general use of electric shock collars is not consistent with animal welfare. It has to be assumed that pet owners do not have sufficient knowledge about training and skill to avoid the risk that dogs will show severe and persistent stress symptoms. For professional dog trainers, the use should be restricted. Proof of theoretical and practical qualification should be required, and the use of these devices should only be allowed in strictly specific situations. Now, what is really interesting about this is apparently the legislature in Germany has been in touch with this professor, and they're what's in the works is no longer allowing shock collars to be sold in general pet stores.
Wow.
And, you know, I think what's really interesting is when I was at Purdue at the behavior modification course I did there, the dogs course, Dr. Lusher is one of the most amazing animal trainers or dog trainers in the country. And he will only use shock collars if the dog's life is in danger.
Right.
So
right.
if it's between the dog dying or getting shocked, mm-hmm. he will use shock.
Right.
But it's a rare occasion. And, you know, one of my biggest reasons, you know, anyone that's listened to this podcast knows that I do not think it's legitimate to use pain or discomfort or the threat thereof to communicate with an animal.
Right, right.
And that's a philosophical position that I have taken. However, I think that there's a practical side to it, too, which is perfect timing is impossible to attain.
Right.
And I have not attained perfect timing with rewards. And I'm pretty good timing-wise with rewards, but there's always the errant misclick that happens once in a while. There's always the late click. And you don't have to be a clicker trainer. I mean, even if you're delivering rewards or praise or play, getting that right on time, because as we discussed, there's that 3-second window of opportunity you have to give feedback to a dog so it associates it with the behavior that's just presented. And so what this study shows is, you know, can shock collars be effective? Yes, if your timing is perfect. Who out there has the confidence to have perfect timing?
Right,
I sure don't.
Well, and we've discussed recognizing that aversive training is out there and it works for people. It's not the way that you choose to train, that I choose to train, that we choose to develop a relationship with our dogs. But I think what's really interesting about this is the black and white of it is the chemical changes in the biology of the canine. If you're incredibly accurate about delivering the positive punishment to the canine subject, you're still increasing the stress levels in that dog as measured chemically 30%.
Right.
If you're not really accurate, it's over 160%. If you're really, really bad, you're approaching 300 to 400% of raising the stress levels. And I think one of the big points here is that not only does that really kind of confuse the situation down the line, because that if you're shocking almost seems random, the results are almost up to raising the stress level 600%, but you're also confusing the situation for the dog to the point where they can't learn.
Right, and one of her points is, are you going to stand out in the woods and wait for the exact moment your dog makes contact
right.
with the deer?
And can you?
Right, I mean, is it mm-hmm. realistic? This was done in a laboratory where perfect timing is a lot easier to attain. And
right,
I would say to people, for those of you that watch The Dog Whisperer, we're actually going to have a future show sort of deconstructing The Dog Whisperer. And I'm not here to bash any other dog trainer.
Sure.
I've said before that there are some components of Cesar Millan's training that I like a lot, that he thinks dogs should get more exercise and live in a more enriched environment, and that they're not surrogate children, that they are dogs and they need to be dealt with. I like all of that. But he does use aversives, and he uses leash corrections, and I would say that his timing is exquisite.
Yeah.
If you watch him, his timing is exquisite.
Well, that's the whispering part, right?
That's, I guess. I mean, for him, yes, that's probably the whispering part. I mean, and like I said, we're going to sort of deconstruct his training methods in a future episode, and I'm going to get some of my pals in here to help, that a vet and another dog trainer. And once again, not a bashing session, but let's really look at what he's doing, you know, why some of it works, what some of the potential fallout is. But this is a perfect example. You know, it's like, clearly, if your timing is dead on, you can have minimal stress impact and an effective training strategy. Now, I would say to people, and I say this all the time because people ask me all the time if I will use positive punishment.
Right.
Why if I don't have to?
Yeah.
I mean, I never said that positive punishment didn't work. Mm-hmm. What I said was positive reinforcement works really well and can be as effective.
Right.
There's
right.
no choice for me. And when people say, well, it's so much quicker, that's not hasn't been proven. And in fact, Ian Dunbar used to go to breed clubs and have timing. Yeah. I'll positively train this dog to sit. You use aversives. Let's see who can do it faster. And he almost beat them all the time. So, but, I mean, when it comes to prey drive, and Temple Grandin brought this up, you know, that's a really hardwired, fixed action pattern that once an animal embarks upon that response, it's really hard to interrupt it.
Yeah.
And Temple Grandin even said this is probably the one case where using a shock collar is acceptable. I'm not going to necessarily disagree with that. I would try to manage the situation. I would try to not put a dog in a situation where they got to chase things, where they were going to be out chasing the wild boars and possibly getting hurt. But I have plenty of clients that live on farms and their dogs chase horses, and their dogs are going to get kicked in the head.
Right, right.
You know, will I use the shock collar? Absolutely not. I don't trust my tongue.
Well, and again, you know, to bring it back to the results of the survey, it seems that for the most part, it's very difficult for people to use this effectively. And when they don't, it incredibly degrades the learning environment for the canine.
Oh, yeah.
So that's, I think that's one of the big takeaways from that.
What and your relationship, right? I mean, it's not, if the dog is so stressed out, it affects that dog's relationship with you.
Well, I that's part of the R group is that, you know, four weeks later, yeah. when... You know, the
just
same
by being in the room.
The same environmental stimulus is introduced. The values cell and acorazole go up.
But what's 600%. Amazing is the trigger wasn't even introduced. It's just we're in the room.
Right, exactly.
The dummy rabbit wasn't even in there.
And that's something that's important to remember, not only when you're talking about positive punishment, but positive reinforcement, I think, is that when you walk in the room with a shock collar or you walk in the room, I should say, when you walk in the room with a history of activating a shock collar or you walk in the room with a history of having a treat bag on your hip, that's going to resonate with the canine that you're working with. And I think one of the things that we've recognized through positive reinforcement training is, and that we like about it, is that our dogs get excited when they see that when we're coming forward to work in the training process, or when we're just coming
forward. Well, in every interaction with them, they trust that there's going to be a payoff, and it doesn't have to be a treat. Yeah. It could be a game of fetch, game of tug. I mean, the very interaction is rewarding for both people.
Right,
because
exactly.
Because there's the absence of the stress.
So, it would be interesting to see the results of the sal and cortisol when it's done with positive reinforcement versus positive punishment.
And once again, could you train a dog not to chase prey using positive reinforcement? Well, you know, that's the question of the day.
We've worked on it with our husky dogs.
And I've definitely seen some improvement. Do I think that it would work with all dogs? And actually use classical conditioning, not positive reinforcement. So
right.
You're using food a little bit differently there. You're making an association change. I don't know. I mean, truth be told, I find it's much more efficient to manage the environment than to try to train that away.
Sure.
There are, you know, Susan Garrett's clearly trained it away by using play.
Right.
I mean, her dogs,
and
she's got border collies, and they could be in the presence of triggers all over the place, so those dogs don't budge. They think she is the center of the universe, and it's because she plays with them.
Sure, yeah,
it's
exactly.
It's not in food treats.
Exactly.
And she plays with them.
And if you want to learn more about Susan Garrett, go back to our website at caninecampus.com, click on the dog with the iPod, and you can look at our episode 2 from the APDT conference on Susan Garrett. Let's talk more about, or let's continue the conversation on to Patricia McConnell.
Patricia McConnell,
yeah.
Who I just worship. I just worship this woman. You know, she has a PhD in zoology.
Mm-hmm.
She considers herself an ethologist, which is the study of animal behavior, but it falls under zoology and not psychology.
It's more observational.
She wrote one of my favorite books ever, The Other End of the Leash, which we've talked about in the past. She also has some great single subject books. So if
right,
you're working
right.
with the fearful dog, the cautious canine, it's like 27 pages. It's fabulous. Way to go is if your dog's having house trading issues. She's got tons of these books. So she has written a new book called For the Love of a Dog, Understanding Emotion in You and Your Best Friend. And what I think is really fascinating about this is, you know, the training method that we use and the terminology we use, positive reinforcement, negative punishment, positive punishment, negative reinforcement, those were given to us by B.F. Skinner and psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And it's B.F. Skinner and that whole group of psychologists that really poo-pooed the idea of emotions in animals.
Right, right.
And part of it was they couldn't quantify it, so how do you study it?
What you can quantify.
Right. Right. So there's kind of, you know, there was this, it's kind of funny because the very field that kind of gave us these wonderful tools to help build this strong communication system with our pets also kind of shut down a really important aspect of that relationship,
right,
which is the
right.
emotions we share. So one of the things I learned is that in 1896, Darwin's second most popular book, so I guess Origin of the Species would be his most popular, was called Expressions of Emotion in Man and Animals.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's really fascinating. Mm-hmm. And he had amazing illustrations, and she showed some in the slideshow. So that's a book I definitely want to take a look at because I think it's really interesting.
Well, we'll put a link to that up on the website.
Yeah. Yes, I think that would be a great idea.
Darwin's always a good read.
So the first thing that Patricia sort of wanted to talk about is kind of what are emotions? What are they about?
Right.
And emotions are very primitive, and they're used to help an animal integrate with its environment. So emotions are centered in the limbic system. And once again, I am not a biologist. So, you know,
right.
I'm following her lead here. If I mess this up, the fault is all mine. Get her book. It's totally accurate.
And we'll
book.
Have a link to it on our website.
I mean, I took scrupulous notes, but just, you know, I want everyone to know that. So the limbic system is also is referred to as the mammalian brain because kind of all mammals have this very central brain. And then, you know, we have other stuff on top of it. And I think what's really interesting is that if you look at our limbic system and you look at the limbic system of a dog, they're virtually identical.
Mm-hmm.
They're virtually identical. And of course, this is one of the reasons why dogs are used in scientific studies, right?
Right.
Medical
right.
research. Okay, so you can't make decisions without the limbic system. This is what's without emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And they've actually done studies where, you know, it's that open brain surgery where the skull's off but the patient's awake and they've activated parts of the brain where the person can't make, you know, one decision. So it's really interesting. Emotions, you think of them as getting in the way of your decisions. They actually really inform your decisions.
And they're a part of the path of decision making.
They're part of the path.
As we understand it right now.
As we understand it right now. And of course, this really did make me think of Malcolm Gladwell and Blink, but we'll get back to that another time. Okay. So apparently, it's universally agreed upon biologists that mammals have emotions.
Mm-hmm.
The controversy exists over which ones they have and whether they are consciously experienced.
Oh, okay.
So let's talk first about which ones they have. Apparently, it's accepted by ethologists and biologists that mammals experience disgust, fear, anger, and happiness.
Mm-hmm.
The controversy exists over social emotions, jealousy, sympathy, and guilt. Those are the ones they're not sure we can look to other mammals to have. But disgust, fear, anger, and happiness, they all seem to agree animals share.
And it's, I think it's worth mentioning that disgust, fear, anger, happiness, when we say ethologists, biologists both confirm these,
They accept them.
They accept these, and it's probably because they've been measured chemically, biologically.
CAT scans, probably.
And behaviorally, which is kind of where
that's where we're going to move next. Okay. So, I mean, once again, this is Patricia McConnell's contention, and since she's in the field. You know, I'm willing to take her word for it. Now, current definition of emotion is made up of three things. One, changes in the body. So those are chemical changes internally. Two, changes in expression. So those are the external display of emotion. Three, the thoughts that accompany one and two. So the thoughts that accompany internal and external changes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's really interesting is that we often think that our thoughts are what cause the external display of emotion.
Right.
Like we think panic and that results in a panicked look on our face.
Right, right.
What's really interesting is that it's actually the opposite. It can be the opposite. I'm not saying it's one or the other. Physical changes can actually result in thoughts. And apparently there's been some really compelling experiments about this.
And this is, you referenced Malcolm Gladwell earlier, Chapter 3, The War on Hardening Error in Blink addresses that.
Addresses that. Really interesting. Nothing about dog training, but it's a really cool book.
It's a great book, yeah.
Okay. Now, one of the things she talked about, I thought this was so fascinating. Back to the dog whisperer for a moment. He was working with a dog that was fearful. It had been a dog that lived out in the country and moved to the city and was terrified of all the noises. And one of the things he did was he tied the dog's tail up. He tied it to the collar in a string so the dog's tail was up to have a happier posture. I'm not going to talk about my feelings about that particular thing.
Not something we would try or recommend.
That's not something I would do. But what Patricia McConnell did, because in that case, the dog had no choice, right? The dog wasn't choosing to put their tail up. The tail was put up on their own. But Patricia McConnell worked with an Akita who was phobic leaving the house. And if anyone's seen an Akita, they have sort of high curly tails most of the time. But, you know, boy, second stepped out of the house, little tail went between its legs. So one of the things she taught it is she clicker trained it to lift its tail.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then when she got it outside, that's the cue she asked for. And it really changed the way this dog interacted with the environment, which I think is fascinating. I would have never thought of it.
Yeah.
And so it might have been why the dog whisperer had some luck with that technique, although to be honest with you, I can't remember if it worked or not with that dog. My bet is not usually well. But because once again, that dog didn't have a choice.
Right.
And with the Akita had a choice, and it was rewarding for the, you know, she made it really rewarding for the dog to lift its tail.
Right.
And that braver stance seemed to help it encounter the world. So I thought that was really interesting. And Patricia McConnell has a lot of interesting cases. I mean, she owns, I think it's called Dog's Best Friend, which is a dog training service, and she has a lot of behavior cases. Okay, so on to the next part of this, which this actually really spoke to me, because everyone knows that's listened to my past podcast how insane I am for proper puppy socialization.
Right, right.
I think it's absolutely essential. And I want to thank Ian Dunbar for really clarifying that for me and really making that. I went to a couple of seminars and read some of his books, and it's mentioned in a lot of books, but for some reason, his take on it really sunk.
It resonates. Yeah.
So anyway, the brain is not in final form at birth, and this is true of humans and dogs. And emotional reactivity is influenced by early development and experience. So this is the socialization period. Now, this is what I thought was really interesting. Environmental complexity causes dendritic branching, which are actually connections between neurons in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So the more complex your environment is, the more of this branching you have. And increased branching reduces stress and reactivity.
It's learning.
I think it's learning. I think it's more pathways for information to follow. And so this is why it's so essential that your puppy is not kept in the house and gets out and about, but it has to be positive.
It's the biometric case for puppy socialization.
That's exactly what it is. It's exactly what it is. And you know, I don't want people to drag their scared little puppy out to the middle of a football game. That's not what I'm suggesting. Socialization has to be happy and fun. People tend to do it too long. You know, if you're going to take your puppy to your kid's game, the puppy needs lots of times away from people. You know, 5 minutes of petting and treats by everyone. They get the puppy out of there. Wow. I mean, it just wants to be fun.
But the bottom line with that is that the proper socialization methods can really help develop the brain and learning facility.
And what's so fascinating on top of that is the structure and neurochemistry of emotions are the same in people and dogs.
Yeah.
Of course, anyone that owns a dog is like, yeah, I know that.
Right.
And, but, you know, I think what I want to caution people about is I don't encounter a lot of clients that think their dogs don't have emotions. I would say the vast majority of my clients, if not all of them, believe their dogs have emotions. I do, however, take case with the emotions they assign their dogs.
Right.
Which is, I was gone all day, so the dog peed on the carpet because the dog was mad at me and trying to get back at me.
Right.
Dogs really don't. It hasn't been proven that dogs have those kind of complicated agendas, and I don't believe those kind of complicated agendas. So I just want to, I mean, I'm all about dogs having emotions, but I think we need to be really smart about what emotions we recognize in our dogs. So in her talk...
And emotion and motivation are very different things.
Yes.
I think emotion is more of a reactive thing. A motivation, well, I did this because you did this, is a very reactive thing. It's thousands of times more complicated in terms of, you know, what we know about the mind and the brain, both for humans and canines.
Yeah.
So it's a big stretch to say that somebody that a dog or a person did something because of something else.
Right. I mean, it's hard enough to know your own intentions,
much less someone else's.
And I would say it's virtually impossible to know a dog's. And I will say this: dogs really live in the moment.
Yeah.
So to think that they can construct a strategy that takes place over an 8-hour period of time, I think it's really unfair to the dog. And, you know, and people say to me, but when I came home, you know, he hung his head down. He clearly was, you know, knew he'd done something wrong. No, you came in pissed.
Right,
and your chemistry was pouring off of you. And your body language changed.
Yeah,
and you probably screamed. And so, you know, what this dog learns is to grovel. It's pure appeasement behavior.
And I'd say, you know, think of, you know, having a bad morning at work and how you end the day at work, and they rarely have anything to do with each other.
I think that's a great point.
Really,
and I would say to anyone that really wants to read something telling, in Jean Donaldson's book, The Culture Clash, which is one of my favorite books, she has a chapter called Empathy 101. And I actually have it in every single one of my dog manuals. Mm-hmm. That's how important I think it is. And I think she explains it very, very well. So,
And Miss Donaldson has actually kindly cleared the copyright on that, so it can be distributed. We should add that. We'll add that to our website.
Yes.
We might be able to add that to this podcast as a PDF file. I think you really have kind of given us a great lowdown on exactly what's going on with McConnell's.
Well, I just wanted to say that she sort of, you know, then she went on to discuss the biology of fear in both humans and dogs, the biology of anger in both humans and dogs, and the biology of joy.
Wow.
And the final day.
She breaks it down, yeah.
And in her book, she really does too. So she has a lot of compelling examples of this. And she's an amazing body language reader of dogs.
Yeah.
She's excellent at reading dogs' expressions. There's very, like, the commissures, which are sort of the corners of the mouth, is for her one of the most telling aspects of a dog, and human too, actually. And so it was very, very interesting. And the last day, she actually gave a lecture on love, on the biology of love.
Uh-huh.
And I missed that. But that's another reason to get the book. So, as usual, Patricia McConnell was incredibly informative, really excellent dog training tips for counter conditioning. There was video that obviously I can't share with you all that was really helpful.
Right.
She had examples of expressions on dogs' faces, the commissures once again compared to that of human beings, similar they are. Now, one story that I want to end on, which I think is really fabulous, I did not realize this, but apparently if you show a newborn baby a picture of a smiley face, and I'm talking two dots and an arc.
Yeah.
They smile.
Really?
Okay, so there's apparently, and I did not know this, but this is what Patricia McConnell said. So apparently there's some sort of, you know, biologically innate response to that.
Wow. Okay.
And then she said, look at your dogs.
Yeah.
Don't they have two eyes and isn't their mouth an arc?
Yeah.
And so part of her, she actually sort of put out there in a playful manner, this could be why we have had dogs in our lives. They bring us joy just by how they look.
We're just tuned.
Yeah. I mean, they've got kind of the biological elements that bring a smile to our face, which I thought was way cool. And it's definitely how I feel about my dogs.
That is really something. And as we mentioned in the past, Patricia McConnell is not only a gifted writer and a talented researcher, but she's a great speaker. And if you have the chance to go see her.
Oh, totally go see her. And she's got a million ideas for PhD dissertations. So if anyone is thinking about going back to school and studying any of this stuff, or is in school and kind of flailing around for a PhD topic, she drops about 10 per lecture.
It's a great
place
to start.
I mean, all I do is just take, you know, she's like, this is great. Who's going to do this? We need a PhD on this.
Exactly.
So she's really a really fun speaker.
The name of the book is For the Love of a Dog, Understand an Emotion in You and Your Best Friend. Devin, welcome back from Kansas City.
Thank you. And I want to thank all the listeners out there. We've had some really tremendous responses to these podcasts.
Yeah.
And it's so cool to me that, you know, it's one thing when you're out at one of these annual conferences, you know you're surrounded by crazy dog people because all of these people have dedicated their lives to dog training. That's why they're there. But to find out that the general public is so interested in this information and it does my heart good, you know, to know that people out there think it's cool and they're really into it. So thank you all for clicking on the download and listening to this.
We're in good company here. And if you want to see videos from the Association of Pet Dog Trainers conference, go to Tawzer Video. Is it TawzerVideo.com?
TawzerZer.com. You can actually buy the entire conference on DVD.
Which is a great way to kind of revisit all of this. We would be remiss if we didn't give a quick plug to the Canine Campus online store, which is new, where you can get the Gentle Leader, the Easy Walk Harness, the Premier Puppy Kit, all the great food toys that Premier offers, and some other great stuff.
Yeah, there's going to be some new items soon. We talked about Premier's new products coming out.
Exactly.
And Katie's bumpers, I'm going to be making an order from them.
Great, excellent.
That will be updated shortly.
So check that out. That's at caninecampus.com, where you can get show notes for this, as well as purchase a lot of the products that we mentioned. And coming up within the next week, we've got a great podcast on therapy dogs,
which I produced myself, so yeah, it's not going to have the same polish as the one Stace does.
It turned out great. We've got our very good friend Blair French from Therapy Dogs International, who sits down with Devin to talk about what it's all about.
And what evaluators are looking for. She was a long-time TDI evaluator, so she's going to give us some tips on what evaluators are looking for
exactly,
when they're certified.
Exactly. So thanks again for listening to the podcast. Thank you, Devin. Welcome home.
Thanks.
And we'll see you on the next show.
Thanks, Stace.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Stace. As you can probably tell, I've snuck out of the studio after the show and wanted to thank you for sitting through our longest and certainly headiest show to date. In keeping with the format and spirit of this APDT special series, we're tagging a great new song we found onto the end of the podcast, a click and treat, if you will, to show our appreciation for the time you've just spent with us. The song is Underdog, the artist is the talented Ann Heaton, and our music this week is courtesy of our friends at the Pod Show PodSafe Music Network. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.
What is the price I will pay for my affair with the underdog? The underdog was my love. So much more handsome and deserving, and summit to you pull me up on my suspender so I can fight alongside of you. Like immigrants, we made it the hard way through languages and the subway. So enamored with our striving, I forgot the price to identify, to be fascinated by you. My love, that's why the story. comfort can be nicer, even though it seems a little bit true. The people who have suffered can be deeper and kinder. If you put on suffering like a coat, if you grab the myth of the underdog about the throat.